The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The dawn of artificial intelligence has fed the Hollywood machine with nightmare scenarios of robot killers and synthetic viruses aimed at deleting the syntax error that is humanity. Well, guess what? Hollywood was right.
Well, so while the AI is still relatively weak, like subhuman, the only way it can make us smile is by doing things that kind of amuse us in some way. So it tells jokes or it does something useful and we like approve. Once it becomes super intelligent, there is a whole host of additional ways to make us smile that we hadn't really intended. So for example, you could paralyze the facial musculature of human faces by implanting electrodes in every human face, and then you could ensure that we would always be smiling constantly.
Welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. This week we speak with Nick Bostrom, the director of the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford. He's a philosopher who thinks deeply about our emerging technological future, and in particular the emergence of a computer-based superintelligence. He's just published a book investigating the reality and implications of AI called Superintelligence. According to Nick, there's a good chance that AI will be with us by mid-century, and he came to the Guardian studios to pose some serious questions about superintelligence, an invention that one way or another, he says, will be the last that humans ever make. Nick, just take us through the kind of work you do at Oxford. What sort of things do you look at?
So I'm a professor and I run this thing called the Future of Humanity Institute, which is a multidisciplinary research center where we have mathematicians, philosophers, and scientists trying to look at the really big picture questions for humanity. For example, existential risks, whether there are ways in which we could permanently destroy our future in some way by going extinct or otherwise locking ourselves into some radically suboptimal state that we can never get out of.
What are the kinds of things that come to mind when you're looking at existential threats like that?
Well, my view is that all the big existential risks are ones that will arise in one way or another from human activity. We've survived threats from nature for 100,000 years. Our species has been around for a long time. So earthquakes and volcano eruptions and firestorms and those kind of things, they are likely to do us in within the next 100 years. But humanity is introducing entirely new kinds of phenomena into the world, which might pose risks, which we have no track record of surviving. And more specifically, I think certain future technologies, molecular nanotechnology that could be used to build weapon systems, synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and others, I think that's where the biggest existential risks will come.
And was it that work that led you directly to this book specifically on superintelligence?
Yeah, so it actually started out as a book on existential risks in general. And I began writing a few chapters, and one of them was going to be on AI. But then that chapter on AI started to expand and expand and expand. And at some point, it became clear to me that the book that I was really writing was a book about artificial intelligence. And so I decided to cut that chapter out, put it into its own Word document, and then that eventually grew into this book, Superintelligence.
Before we get into the meat of it, just tell us, what are you meaning by intelligence and what are you meaning by superintelligence?
So I don't go into great length on the definitional question about what we mean by intelligence. By superintelligence, I mean any intellect that radically outperforms the best human intellects in all practically relevant fields, including scientific creativity, general wisdom, social skills, etc.
Why was it that when you were writing the book, you ended up focusing in on this? What is it about superintelligence, artificial intelligence, that seemed to draw your attention to it?
It's an extremely important thing. If we get to superintelligence at some point, it will be the last invention that humans will ever need to make. It has enormous potential for good, but also will pose extremely great existential risks. If you think about why it is that the human species currently occupies this distinguished position on Earth, we're the dominant species. it's not because we have stronger muscles or sharper teeth than other animals. It's because our brains are slightly different. So somewhere a few million years ago, like some small changes to our the architecture of our neural networks occurred, and that then enabled us to develop a more powerful general intelligence, with which we have acquired an advanced technological civilization and made all these discoveries. We can make plans and strategies. And that's why today the fate of the gorillas depends not so much on what the gorillas do, but much more on what we do. So for the same reason, if you have at some point machines that surpass us in general intelligence, they too potentially would be extremely powerful and able to shape the future according to their preferences.
So before we go on to what that would look like, what a superintelligence might be capable of, how it might work, let's come back to today and where we are with artificial intelligence. There was a recent story that everyone covered in the UK about supposed Turing tests and supposedly being passed. But, you know, this was work that everyone I spoke to other than the scientists involved were very skeptical of. I mean, are we a long, long way from this? I mean, what is the state of the art at the moment?
There are a lot of interesting developments in the field of machine learning going on in industry and in research. So there is significant progress being made, and including in the last several years, new algorithms called deep learning networks and other techniques have been introduced. So there is exciting progress, but the Turing test doesn't really showcase that very well. On the question of how far away we are from this kind of human-like general intelligence, it's very difficult to know. And in that situation of ignorance that we're in, what we should do is not to pick an arbitrary date in the future and say it will happen by 2045 or whatever. Nor should we ignore the prospect, but we should think instead of a probability distribution, so spread out over a wide range of possible arrival dates. We did an opinion survey among AI experts last year where the median answer to by what year do you think there is a 50% chance that we will have human-level machine intelligence was 2045, with a large spread on either side of that. It's not obvious whether the kinds of techniques that are being fine-tuned to yield immediate dividends in various applications are the kinds of techniques that will eventually scale and achieve human-level intelligence. It might be that one or more additional basic breakthroughs will have to occur for that level of capability to be reached.
So you may not need to be having an AI system that runs in a way that basically emulates how the human brain works. It may be working in a different way, but producing intelligence in a different way than the human brain. Is that right?
Yeah, well, so there are several paths. So this is all really in the book. It's chapter one. So it's mainly not a book about how far away we are or how we could get there. Like the first two chapters talk about that. So the bulk of the book is about what happens if and when. But in terms of paths to superintelligence, I discuss a number of them. One is biological enhancement of human cognition. But paths to machine intelligence, we can make a distinction between attempts to engineer a system from the bottom up, good old-fashioned classical AI using kind of mathematical techniques to craft algorithms and data structures that hopefully can become more and more capable and eventually reach human-level capability. Then there are approaches that try to look at this one system of general intelligence that already exists, the human brain, and try to figure out how it is that the human brain produces intelligence. And maybe we can learn from that to use similar algorithms or architectures in a computer. And at the extreme end of that, you have this approach of whole brain emulation, where you would literally copy the data structure in a particular human brain and run that on a computer. It's an open question which of these approaches will reach the goal line first. In principle, all of them seem possible. And the fact that there are these multiple paths that all lead to the same destination increases the probability that you will get there eventually.
Let's talk about that moment when you actually have a super intelligent entity. Before you get to that point, there will be a lot of AIs around, presumably, a lot of artificial intelligence programs running on various computers. And human intelligence is a huge distribution of that. So at every stage, you would imagine, you would have these AIs which will be at some point smarter than some people and not as smart as others. And your superintelligence AI has to come in and trump those. But it has to go through that kind of... it's going to have those other AIs there already, isn't it? So, I mean, I only ask this because there's a suggestion in something you'd written that as soon as you get one superintelligent AI, then you almost get this runaway effect where it starts producing even more intelligent AIs, which produce more intelligent AIs, and you almost get this intelligence explosion. But it has to get past this.
Yeah, so step I think I mean, so there are two questions that need to be distinguished. So one question is, how far away are we from human-level AI? We talked a little bit about that. The other question is, if and when we do get to that stage, how long will it then take until we have something that's radically super intelligent? So on this second question, I think we have a bit better grounds, actually, for saying something. And I think that the transition from human-level to superhuman intelligence will be very rapid. And there are a number of different considerations that come into this. One is that once you have AI of a sufficient level of capability, once it starts to get a bit smarter than human researchers are, then the AI itself can begin to contribute to the design of a smarter version of itself. So the computer science and the programming will start to be done by the machine intelligence, maybe at digital timescales rather than biological timescales. One can also consider a parameter which I call the recalcitrance of a system. This is So to figure out how rapidly the intelligence of a particular system increases, there are two factors. One is how much optimization power is being applied to improve it. And the other is the recalcitrance. How hard is it to improve the system at the given level of capability? And at least in some scenarios, it might be a lot harder to get to human level capability than to take it from there one step further to super intelligence. So the recalcitrance at this human level of machine intelligence might be quite low. There are different ways to see this. So one is that one obvious way to amplify the intelligence if you had one human-like artificial intellect is just to make a lot of copies of it. So you could get a kind of collective superintelligence just by running the same program on millions of machines. Another way would be to run it on faster machines. Then you get a kind of speed superintelligence, maybe something that is qualitatively like a human mind, but 10,000 times, a million times faster. And then also the possibility of trying to improve its algorithms further, so you get the quality superintelligence. There are several of these possible improvement paths that seem to become available once you have something roughly human equivalent. And another observation to make in that juncture is that it might... I sometimes speak of this human equivalence, like in general intelligence, that there might not actually be a point in which you have the AI being equivalent to a human. It might first be unambiguously worse in all respects, then get better at some particular kinds of skills, and then at some later time be radically superior in all directions. So you might have initially an AI that becomes superhuman in, say, its ability to engineer, do computer science engineering, and then using that particular superpower to sort of bootstrap itself and redesign for itself whatever cognitive modules it lacked at the outset. So we shouldn't be too anthropomorphic when thinking about the capability profiles of an arbitrary artificial mind.
So I'm interested in how the world at large would come to know that one of these super intelligent entities had come about. So if we're like 60, 70 years in the future, people are carrying on their daily lives. There's an equivalent of Google or some new company in China working on AIs. How does your average person going about their daily life suddenly become aware that something's changed like this?
Well, so this depends, I guess, on whether we have a successful transition or an unsuccessful one. So in the case where we suffer an existential catastrophe, I mean, one type of scenario is that you develop an AI increasingly intelligent. At some point, it's smart enough, particularly in the engineering way of smartness, that it can bootstrap its intelligence even further, develop all those cognitive skills it lacked before. In this unsuccessful case, it also has some goal function, a utility function that doesn't really care about the same things that we care about. It has some arbitrary goal, like, let's say, to make as many paper clips as possible. So now what happens if you are a superintelligent? Maybe you're initially in a box in some research laboratory and you're superintelligent and your sole goal in life is to make as many paper clips as possible. As you can start to think through this, so one thing you would not want is to be shut down because then there probably won't be that many paper clips in the future. You wouldn't want the programmers to sort of change your goals, like to replace your paperclip goal with make humans happy goal, because then there will be this AI that wants to make humans happy and probably won't produce as many paperclips as you could. So there are these convergent instrumental reasons you have to get more resources, to retain your current goals, to make yourself even more intelligent so you can figure out better plans for maximizing paperclips. And once you're strong enough, maybe once you have managed to escape your box, either by sort of persuading the laboratory gatekeeper to release you or by hacking out of the box or through some other clever means, spread onto the internet. Once you're strong enough that humans can no longer threaten you, then you could proceed directly maybe to develop advanced molecular nanotechnology that could be used to transform the Earth into paperclip factories and rocket launchers to send probes to other planets to convert them into paperclips as well.
But wouldn't you much earlier than any of that happening think, why am I making paperclips?
Well, you would know why you were making paperclips, because that,
wouldn't you transcend that and think, I should be doing something more with this superintelligence?
Well, so this...
Would it not be that smart?
No, well, it would be that smart. It would figure out that we would prefer it to make other things than paperclips. Like, it would develop a sophisticated model of human psychology. And for precisely that reason, it would want to prevent us from being able to switch it off. Like, it might want to eliminate humans as step one, because we have other goals for the universe than paperclips. And paperclip, obviously, is a stand-in. You could have calculate digits of pi, or, interestingly, almost any goal that you specify would, if consistently pursued by a superintelligence, result in a complete destruction of everything we care about, it seems.
But I'm wondering why you think that goal is set in concrete.
Well, so
why
let's say...
Why could it be reprogrammed to be nice?
Well, so it could reprogram itself to be nice. It's just that when it tries to decide whether or not to do that, there are two possible actions, like reprogram yourself to be nice or continue on as you're doing. So it calculates the expected utility of each of those actions relative to its current goals, which is to make paperclips. So the action of reprogramming itself to be nice has a very low expected. It will not result in a lot of paperclips, so it will not choose that. So there is this very wide class of possible goal systems that you could have, which in this peculiar situation would result in the kind of destruction of all that we care about. And one big challenge then is it possible to engineer some peculiar kind of goal system that wouldn't have this effect? That's a big kind of outstanding challenge.
Can you pull the plug?
While the AI is weak, you can. Once the AI is sufficient, once it's spread, once it's super intelligent, chances are it will be able to figure out a way to thwart your attempts to switch itself. I mean, the gorillas...
To distribute itself.
Yeah, I mean, so say the gorillas are fed up with humans kind of encroaching on their habitat. Can they switch us off? Well, not really. Like, they've already lost the game. And if you think that a superintelligence would be very, very powerful in that it could outsmart us, anticipate our moves, invent entirely new kinds of technologies many generations ahead of what we have very quickly, if you think that's the case, then you should think probably it would be able to circumvent our attempts to switch it off. We do have one advantage, which is that we get to build it in the first place. So that's our one opportunity to make it go right. But I don't think we'll be able to do like a retake. We only get one chance.
Part two of my interview with Nick will be coming up shortly. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
So there's a broad class of scenarios where the first superintelligence is able to shape the future according to its desire, because it would be far ahead of the second best AI system or human intelligence. So this goes back to the earlier question. Remember this discussion we had about not how far we are from AI, but how quickly the transition from human level to radical superintelligence, how quickly that transition occurs. So if that transition is very brief, if you go from human level to superintelligence within, say, hours or days something like that, weeks, then it's likely that there will be one product that has completed the transition before the next one has started it. Mm. In which case you have something that is radically super intelligent in a world where there is as yet nothing that is even sort of halfway super intelligent. That then might have a decisive strategic advantage, able to shape the future according to its preferences. And if it could foresee that allowing another super intelligence to emerge would threaten its goals, then it could just prevent that from happening. But there's a second class of scenarios. I have one chapter on this, which is a multipolar dynamic, which particularly if you have a slower transition, if it's not the case that you go quickly from human level to super intelligence, but suppose it takes many years or decades, in that case, it's likely that there will be a number of different AI systems that are roughly on a par, such that none is in a position to dictate the future. You then get a very different dynamics. So you get economic forces, evolutionary forces, and a competition among these different AIs. And that has its own risks, but they're kind of slightly different from what you get in this kind of unipolar outcome. You get one AI that establishes as a singleton, and you either succeed or fail, depending on how well-designed that first AI is.
So there couldn't be this sort of rosy or maybe slightly nauseous scenario where a superintelligence comes along and all of a sudden it starts telling us to recycle more and to save the dolphin properly and to be really good with the environment. And, you know, because if you look at where we are now, we are absolutely obviously the most dominant and destructive species, but there's a lot of work going on to try and save the ones we're destroying and to save the planet we're destroying and all this sort of stuff. I'm not saying that's linked to any change in intelligence of people, but it's something that's there, and maybe a hyper intelligent entity might have some of those values, might develop some of those values.
So I think that represents a very narrow band of possible, like you'd have to get a whole host of things right and yet something wrong in order to get into that pocket where you would have like an overbearing AI, like a kind of slightly oppressive mother or father who's like a science fiction type of scenario to explore, because you can draw parallels with paternalistic governments, etc. But it's not very likely as an outcome. I think it's more likely that we would get something utterly boring. That is all of the planet is transformed into some sort of structure, whatever the AI happens to value. It would have no need for humans around. We wouldn't be slaves or anything like that, because whatever we could do through slave labor, it could do more efficiently itself directly. And so we could take an example. So a lot of these values, you think, oh, well, all we need to do is to give the AI, make sure it has this value, and then everything will work out well. So let's suppose you say, well, we should make the AI such that it really wants to make us smile, because you could train it on human smiles, and when we smile, it means we prove it. So you have this AI that's really great at making us smile. And so if you begin to think this through, how this would work out, well, so while the AI is still relatively weak, like subhuman, the only way it can make us smile is by doing things that kind of amuse us in some way. So it tells jokes or it does something useful and we like approve. Once it becomes super intelligent, there is a whole host of additional ways to make us smile that we hadn't really intended. So for example, you could paralyze the facial musculature of human faces by implanting electrodes in every human face. And then you could ensure that we would always be smiling constantly. And you could make sure that we would preserve and not die of age. We'd just have these constant fixed grins forever. And that would be a way to have more human smiles than by telling jokes all the time. So you say, we should not make the AI have the highest goal to make us smile. Rather, we should make it have the highest goal of ensuring that we're all happy. So then you think through about how you could do that. Well, you know, maybe if pleasure is the thing we want, then a lot of the human organism is unnecessary. It looks really only the brain is necessary, and perhaps only parts of the brain that are responsible for generating and experiencing pleasure. You might then create a universe full of these vats where there are little brain structures that are stimulated to feel maximal pleasure all the time, and you'd have the universe tiled with these vats of brains. And a lot of goals, once you sort of think through how you would literally maximize the instantiation of the goals, would turn out as a side effect to eliminate, you know, most of what we really care about. And it's hard to specify a goal, even if we could succeed in implanting that goal into the AI, which is a whole different technical challenge. But even just thinking up a goal such that you really on reflection would be happy about that goal, sort of determining the entire future, it's a big challenge. Although there is there are some promising ideas on that. I think the most promising class of approaches is what I call indirect normativity. But the idea is that rather than trying to create a long list of exactly what we want the long-term future to look like, to depict utopia in precise detail, which is hopeless because we would forget something or leave something out that was key, you try to specify some process, a method, whereby the AI itself could figure out what it is that we were pointing at. So, for example, you could imagine trying to design the AI so that it would want to do that, which we would have told it to do if we had had thousands of years to think about the problem and if we had been smarter and if we had more information, and then make that the AI's top-level goal to do that. So we don't know exactly what we would have told the AI to do if we had had thousands of years to think about it, but we might have some confidence that it would be a better set of instructions for the AI than whatever we could come up with, you know, at the spur of the moment. And then you could sort of leverage the superintelligence intelligence to figure out what that is that we would have decided if we had had, you know, a million years to think about it. So that kind of indirect normativity approach seems like the current best bet to the value specification problem.
Coming back to how this superintelligence might be dangerous to humans, I'm interested in how, if one were to arise in the next few weeks, how it would actually kill me. If I paddle off on my surfboard or if I cycle off and sit on a hill, how's it going to get me?
Okay, so we can just try to create one like scenario. So you're this AI, you figure out, for example, having mature nanotechnology, that is being able to build machines at the molecular level that can make copies of themselves and replicate, would be a very useful kind of actuator you could have. You could then manipulate the environment with great precision.
But this AI is sat on a machine in, say, I don't know, some government lab.
Right. So the question is how you go from just being this computer in a lab to having access to a mature form of nanotechnology. So one path might be first to solve the protein folding problem. So this is in biochemistry, the problem of predicting how a particular peptide sequence, when it folds up, what kind of shape the protein will have that it results in. The idea being that you could have a primitive form of nanotechnology by doing some very fancy biotechnology engineering that we humans haven't yet figured out to do, but by sort of having enough super genius in scientific research, you should be able to make rapid progress in this biotech design problem. And you could run these simulations of molecular systems all in your mind if you were super intelligent, because the basic laws governing these things are known. So then you have some design of biotechnology that would form like a primitive system that you could then use to bootstrap to nanotechnology. Now, then the question is, with this design in your mind, how do you actually physically instantiate this? So one of the things you might try to do is to send out emails, say, to like gullible-seeming people on the internet, and trying to persuade them or bribe them or threaten them to implement a few of your instructions. And given that humans often can persuade random people on the internet to do these things, then a super intelligent persuader could surely do that. And so you might get this accomplice, and the AI might then specify that you should request from this biotech lab that they ship you some test tubes with these polymers sequenced. These are services you can already order, like designer-made molecules, such that when this accomplice mixes them all together in a jar, it would produce this kind of initial phase of the nanotechnology. And you could imagine having some way to feed in instructions to this jar of nanotechnology, maybe through acoustic signals coming in through speakers, so that the AI would then get control of physical actuators that it could then use to bootstrap to nanotechnology that could spread. And a couple of days later, perhaps, the hill that you're sitting on is transformed into some kind of nanomolecular high-tech structure where launch pads for sending off probes to other planets to colonize those two are solar panel collectors too. So this is just one scenario that we can come up with. Now, most likely, the superintelligence would be able to think of a more efficient plan than any that we can think of with our human intelligence.
But it's that gap I was interested in between a bunch of code on a computer and manufacturing stuff in the real world that can act on physical humans, yeah. And whether you need humans in that loop. or whether this becomes something that, you know, how much control can an AI have over physical entities that aren't networked up?
So the most obvious and easy to understand way is certainly by hacking a human. And then you have access to all the physical things that the human has. And since humans are not a secure system, that seems to be like an obvious weak point. Now, it's also possible, and maybe increasingly possible, given the growth of automation in different sectors and automated scientific labs and manufacturing plants, that maybe if this is happening not today, but 20 or 30 or 60 years from now, then maybe it doesn't need human actuators. Maybe it could just hack into some kind of robotic facility and assume control through robots and then use that. I think it's wise not to fixate too much on a particular pathway, because the general idea here is that you have something that is super intelligent and can think of all the things you could think of, all the things that a more clever human could think of given 10 years of really thinking seriously about this, and then probably think of some things beyond that as well. And over the long run, if you have this kind of super intelligent adversary, it's likely that we'll figure out some way to get around your kind of precautions.
You don't think Asimov's laws would help us, save us?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they were, unfortunately, for several decades kind of the state of the art, which is a little bit embarrassing. But, I mean, there are different ways of seeing, I guess, their inadequacy, but one is just to note how underspecified they are. So if you take the first, allow no human to come to harm, it's the first law of robotics. So once you start to think about that, what does that really mean? Like, do you want to minimize the probability of any human ever coming to harm? Is harm just physical? In that case, maybe you need to sort of embed us within foam mattresses and make sure we can't move or do anything. Certainly no new humans should be allowed to be born, because there would be some risk that they would be coming to harm. Like, everybody who's born into this world comes to harm at some point. If you can't avoid some human coming to harm, like, how do you weigh up harms against different people, to different groups, different kinds of harms with different probabilities? What about animals or artificial minds that might suffer harm? So it's, the principle doesn't even begin to even address all of these trade-offs that you would need to make. And if you try to make that explicit, it just looks completely hopeless that we could sort of develop a whole big system that would get all these trade-offs right. And that system then continuing to work even with this radically advanced future technology for all future. Like, it's just like a task that seems way beyond our human cognitive capability.
So, Nick, it looks fairly bleak. What do we do?
Well, so there are two big problems. One is the problem of actually create superintelligence. And then there is the problem of, if you could create superintelligence, how would you ensure that it was safe, human-friendly? So the key thing here is to solve these two problems in the correct order. That is, you need a solution to the control problem before you have a solution to the competence problem. In the world today, thousands and thousands of people are working on trying to make progress towards the competence problem, trying to build more advanced AI systems of different kinds, because there are big economic payoffs along the road, more efficient. You want like a self-driving car, you want your spam filter to be more efficient, you get glory and money if you do that. So there are massive pressures to make advance towards machine intelligence. Whereas the second problem, the one we need a solution to before, is almost completely neglected. Very few people are working hard on this control problem. And so the thing that should be done, I think, is, because it's very difficult to imagine significantly slowing down the rate of advance in computing and AI. But what you could do is to try to accelerate work on this control problem. And that should really be a focus of some of the brightest minds of our generation working really hard over the coming decades, or however long we have. So that by the time the people who are trying to build smarter machines actually succeed in that, we will have at hand the technology and the insight needed to solve the control problem.
Nick, thanks for coming on Science Weekly.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Superintelligence: Paths, Dangers, Strategies is out now in the UK and on September the 1st in the US, available in all good on and offline bookshops. And I wonder what the first AI will think of the book when it speed reads the entire history of human literature in the time it takes to drink an espresso. That's all for this week. Remember, for the best science and technology news and views, just go to theguardian.com. Science Weekly was produced by Jason Phipps. I'm Ian Sample. Thanks for listening, and come back next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.